Welcome back to the Roundtable. I'm Katie Britton. For 17-year-old Mia, life can't be the same, as her spirit's hanging in limbo after her family's car crashes, leaving her the only potential survivor. So begins Gail Forman's novel, If I Stay. Throughout the book, and now movie being released this Friday, we're brought into a world no one should ever have to face, to choose to live or die. And we follow Mia as she makes this hard decision while in a coma.
Well, teenage girl, that's sort of an easy one. Those are the characters that always seem to sort of jump into my mind and demand that I write about them. In terms of the story itself, it's a little more complicated, a little more personal. About 10 years ago, some friends of ours were in an accident very much like the one that Mia and her family are in. And unfortunately, they were all killed. But by the time I heard about the accident, they'd all died. It was two adults and two children, and one of the children had lived a little bit longer and been medevaced to a trauma center, and he eventually succumbed. But that always haunted me. I always wondered, did he know that the rest of his family had died, and did he choose to go with them? And I sort of thought about him alone on a helicopter being medevaced. So that sort of haunted me and sort of tormented me. It was part of my grieving process for years and years and years. And somehow, 7 or 8 years later, sort of after I had kind of dealt with that and processed that, this character of Mia popped into my head completely out of the blue. And she was going to take me on this journey to answer that question, not so much as it pertained to sort of the real life people, but as it pertained to her. And when I started writing, I didn't really know what her answer was going to be. I didn't know until I was about halfway through the book whether she would stay or not stay.
Does it take a lot out of you to write about that life in limbo of all the characters having to deal with their grief and what-ifs, as well as your main character, Mia's?
It was a really intense process. I mean, it was very, very emotional. People often ask me, did you cry while writing it? And I did. I probably cried where people cry reading it. But it was also, you know, there was something sort of very uplifting and cathartic, because even though I think from the outset, if you hear about this book, you think, oh, what a downer. But I like to think of it as a book that's really sort of a series of love stories. I mean, there's so much love in this book between Mia and her family and Mia and her boyfriend Adam and Mia and her friend Kim and, of course, Mia and music. So writing about all of that was so incredibly nourishing. And I think the reason that the book is structured the way it is, which is it's this 24-hour period where Mia is outside of her body and watching as, you know, she's being taken care of by doctors and nurses and sort of in this very critical state, and then flashing back to this sort of rather wonderful life that she had, is in part because I needed this sort of these breaks to go. The present day was pretty intense, and so I needed these sort of happy breaks. So I think that it balanced out the writing process, that I was able to take these breaks from the present day hospital scenes, some of which aren't all that heavy, and go into this sort of Mia's wonderful path, which was just such a delight to write.
The dynamic of Mia's family is so interesting. The parents are people we would want to know and have as parents. They're cool, loving, supportive of their children's thoughts and decisions, yet they give them the freedom to make their own decisions.
Right. I mean, this is a dynamic I've seen with some friends of mine that I've known who had children very young. Mia's parents got pregnant with her when they were 21, 22. They were already married, but they were sort of young and punk rock and pretty bohemian at that point. They weren't planning on having kids, but they had Mia, and she was sort of like this peer that they had, and kind of, as Mia's dad said, you were kind of like an experiment, and you went surprisingly well. So they raised her with, you know, definitely as a child and with boundaries, but also with sort of sense of respect, and we're going to let you do what you want as long as it's safe for you. And so Mia kind of grew up not having much to rebel against in terms of her parents. In fact, in some ways, she takes on this parental role, although her parents are quite responsible. And so it's a dynamic that I've seen with friends of mine who had children who were young and who were the only ones in that peer group that had kids. So Mia's sort of the one child raised by this community of artists. So I think that in that particular case, you kind of get this sort of situation where the kids sort of turn out like that. You know, with Teddy, he was 10 years later, maybe it would have been more traditional childhood for him.
Mia's 17 and an amazing cello player, and her family's musical as well, but just in a different way.
Right. Her family, they come from the rock background. And so when Mia is 8 years old and is at school and sort of sees that cello in the corner and it sort of calls to her and her family finds out about that, they're kind of shocked by it and amused initially. But, you know, they let her go with it. But that's sort of Mia's issue. She feels like a fish out of water in her family. She doesn't look like her family, and she's chosen this classical path. And her family, I don't think they fully understand her. I mean, they want to support her, but Mia's a little bit of a strange specimen to them, not just because she's a classical musician, but also, you know, this temperament of hers. She's kind of a little worldly wise for her age. But, you know, her parents love her. They love her unconditionally, and they support her. She's a cellist. They don't quite get it, but they get the love of music, and that's something that binds them all, that binds Mia and her mom and her dad and certainly Adam.
I was going to say, with Adam, she always wondered why he liked her when she was so different from him.
Right. I mean, Adam is the rock guy, and, you know, he could have any pick of girls in town. He's in a band that's up and coming, and Mia's, you know, she's not shy, but she's not sort of out there and aggressive girl. And Adam sort of comes after her. And what initially draws them together is this sort of spark of mutual musical obsession. And then there's something else, obviously, that keeps them together. But in the beginning, Mia just doesn't get it. She feels like a fish out of water with her family. But, of course, family's stuck with you. They have to love you. But with Adam, she doesn't understand it. He doesn't have to love her. So why does he love her?
And I really liked him. At first, I thought he was going to turn into kind of like a punk, but everything he did and said just made me like him more.
He's a good guy. He's a good sort of emo core guy with a big heart. So, yeah I got a little crush on Adam myself.
Grams is one of my favorite characters in the book. When we're in the flashbacks and he understands how perceptive Mia is, and then when he's in the hospital at her bedside, I was just thinking, oh, you were just a wonderful, wonderful man.
He doesn't say a lot, but when he does, it's the right thing. So he's one of those people, you know, still waters run deep. So you have Gran on the other hand, one hand, who chatters away and talking. And then there's Gramps, who just kind of sits there and doesn't talk a lot. And he's not very physically demonstrative. But when, you know, when Gramps gives you a hug, when Gramps says something, it's the right thing. And Gramps delivers, you know, really the ultimate gift for Mia for what she really needs here. And I like to think that, you know, no matter what would happen with Mia, Gramps is going to be a real support for her one way or the other.
When we're in the hospital scenes, she's not a ghost. It's not as if she can walk through walls, which she finds out herself.
Right.
But at the same time, she has that conscious out-of-body experience that she can see what is going on at the hospital.
You know, I've heard of people who have sort of been in accidents or just in general have had out-of-body experiences, and so it just seemed that you are sort of outside your body. And so it's never happened to me personally, so I had to make myself a list of rules of, you know, what Mia could and could not do. And I wanted it to be sort of as simple as possible. I wanted her to be able to observe what she saw in front of her, but that was it. So that was basically it. I didn't want it to sort of be supernatural, magical. Sometimes I see the book described as a, you know, fantasy book, and I raise my eyebrows at that because, you know, I've heard of people having out-of-body experiences, especially in situations like this where you're in a critical accident. And so that's what I wanted it to be. It was very important, especially given the premise of the book. If somebody had some kind of, you know, cognizance of what's going on and was able to choose, and they had to have some awareness. And the only way I could think for that to happen was for Mia to be sort of outside of her body and an observer. So, you know, she's not a ghost. She's alive, and, you know, her body is unconscious, but she's just watching this. And it's the same Mia that would have been alive, you know, a day or two before, but she's just watching herself. So, no, she has no magical abilities. She's not quite sure, you know, at least initially, sort of how, if she were to make the decision to live or die, how to execute that.
When you began writing, was it a conscious decision not to have Mia's family, who dies in the car crash, be with her or make an appearance to her as she's trying to choose?
Nothing was conscious. I sort of sat down. I didn't even know if it was going to be a book. The original title, when I saved it on my computer, was Why Not? Because it didn't really seem like a viable novel. I didn't have an agent. I didn't have a publishing contract. I just wanted to sort of go with it. I wasn't sure if it was therapy. So I sat down and just started going. But I knew that Mia was very much had to be solitary. And there would be this tug of war. played out sort of with the flashbacks and sort of the life that she had and the people who were trying to sort of keep her here and the people who were gone that she was pulled toward. So I definitely knew that I didn't want like spirits coming toward her. And she's wrestling with some sort of existential questions. Like she doesn't know if there's an afterlife and that's not answered. And she doesn't have the comfort of believing one way or another securely in that or having any evidence of that one way or another. So she doesn't know if she chooses to go, if she'll see her parents immediately or what will happen. So that sort of adds to her agony because it's just not clear. She does not have any guarantees. None of us do.
There's an interesting moment in the book when she hears the nurses talking about the person that had hit the car and that he was pretty much okay. And she thought, well, if I wake up, I could go and find him and tell him that it's not his fault, but would that really help because they'll be wrestling with this for the rest of their life?
Right. You know, she's thinking about this man who just was going out for a drive and she doesn't know the cause of the accident. Nobody does. She overhears people saying, you know, nobody knows what it was. It was an ice slick. But, you know, there's this person, all of them were just sort of driving along and all of their lives were just altered completely. And here's this person, blameless, and he has, through no fault of his own, completely changed this family. And Mia feels some sense of compassion for him. She wants to sort of go out and say, like, it's not your fault, and could we become friends? But then she thinks, oh, it'd probably just be awkward. But, you know, that's just who Mia is, that she would think about that.
Again, the name of Gail Forman's novel is If I Stay. It is published by Dutton. And you can also experience all the beauty of Forman's novel on the silver screen beginning this Friday, August 22nd. You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.